Okay.
Well, good morning. It's the 16th of November, the 22nd lecture of the semester. So we're now entering the final quarter, final turn. A week from Wednesday, that's 9 days away, the lecture just before Thanksgiving break is on mobile and multimedia information retrieval, a topic that just cries out for demos. And since this is one of the topics I don't know as much about as other ones, I'm hoping that all of you who are mobile and multimedia people would love to volunteer to find cool demos and show them. I'd like to take like the last 15, 20 minutes of the class and have demos and stuff. So if you have any interest in demoing cool multimedia or mobile IR stuff, let me know in the next day or two and we'll figure out how to make that part of the class work as demo land. You should all have gotten feedback on assignment 6. The principal tag and the Flickr are delicious. I thought they looked really good in general. I think that Ben Cohen regrets suggesting his own site, Heliostatic, for people to look at because he got a lot of criticism and he didn't like that very much. I should have waited for him to show up to tell him that, but I noticed in his feedback people he said, you shouldn't have criticized Heliostatic so much. It's not that terrible of a site. But that's what you get by using your site as an example. Assignment 7, which is the last one you require to do, is out. I hope that you have looked at it at least so you understand what you're up against. And I think today's section will be talking about that. I know that some of you are building tools in the I.O. lab that will do that assignment. That's the last assignment and one of the last optional assignments, optional task in the I.O. lab is to build tools for doing vectors and vector visualization and graphic and all that stuff. And so if they finish in time, I'm going to make that available to everybody else to use for the assignment because I think the conceptual parts are important and not the actual drawing of the vectors so much and so on. However, since you don't know if they're going to finish in time, I would not wait till last minute to see if the magic software is going to show up and save you. So you should be looking at that assignment. There will be one more assignment, but it will be optional. You can take it if you want to throw out your worst grade of the assignments. You can replace it with this one or something. It'll be the day we have Alumni Day, and you'll write about one of the talks of the one or more talks from the alumni. That's the 7th of December, the last Monday of the semester before the exam. And I've invited back and have tentative confirmations from Monomarks of Google, Jana Shamas from Twitter, Carolyn Craycraft from Primitive Logic, Zach Gillen from Kaiser, Lisa Delarios from Recommind, Kathleen Liu from Chevron, and Shauna Hine from someplace else. These are all alumni doing I.O. kind of jobs, and they're going to talk about their jobs. It's a good way to kind of synthesize a lot of the stuff of the semester and make you realize that what you're doing here actually does matter in your life when you get a job and stuff. Eric Horvitz of Microsoft Research is giving a talk tomorrow, the Citrus Lecture. I'm going to send out a note about that. He's a very distinguished researcher in the area of sort of smart stuff, intelligent networks, sensors, and it's actually a lecture which is quite relevant to 202 as well as ISSD, so if you're in both those classes, you should definitely try to make that lecture tomorrow at 2 o'clock, I think. My course next semester that I've been talking about has been approved by the dean. It's going to be called Updating the Intellectual Foundation of Information Organization, or Rollover Spinonius. It's been approved as 290-10. It'll be one or two units, depending on whether you want to write a chapter and be an editor of a bunch of stuff, or just be one of the research workers who helps find the stuff forward those of you who are in the I.O. lab, I'm also inviting you to come in that class. I think it would be fun to consolidate some of the I.O. lab demos and build like the mother of all demos. So instead of there being 21 versions of Delicious and Mimics, we'll have the best one. We'll sort of synthesize some of the examples. And that should be fun. It's scheduled, I think, like Monday afternoon at 4 o'clock, but it will meet whenever it makes sense for us to meet. And we'll not meet every week because it'll be more like you go to Ogre, then you go do the work and we meet every couple of weeks or something. So it'll be a fairly fluid kind of thing. Because I don't want to be on campus all the time. I'm supposed to take the semester off to do other stuff. But we're gonna rewrite Spinonius next semester. So just think what it'll be like next fall to have chapters written by all of you rather than by Spinonius. It'll be a whole different experience in 202, I think. Now on to today's lecture. Today is it's challenging material, but I think really important. So I'm going to start with a big picture view of the problem we're trying to solve today. To motivate dimensionality reduction as a conceptual idea before we actually talk about the mechanics of doing latent semantic indexing from a technical standpoint. So today's lecture is one that is really for Sean Montepietri and Rochelle Lenecchio and Dan Byler and all the NLP folks, it's really up that kind of stuff that we're talking about. We talk a lot about sort of how to think about NLP from the 202 context. Those are the people who are in NLP, right? Those four of you?
Yeah.
Dan Byler. I know Yosheng is in it too, right? He's an NLP guy, so this is for you too. All right. So we'll start with limitations of the vector model. Then I'll make this very broad brushed caricatured contrast between linguistic and statistical approaches to NLP, because that's really the heart of this task. We'll try to motivate the idea of reducing dimensionality, and then we'll talk about how it actually works, and I'll show you some examples. But if you, as we said many times this semester, the core problem we're trying to solve in IR is to find relevant documents and then figure out some way to order them by relevance. And the IR model, as a general approach, explains how we solve those problems. Okay? It tells us how to represent the documents, how to calculate some notion of similarity or relevance, which we'll use to order them, and then optionally find some way to take feedback about relevance to improve the calculations and the ordering the next time. Again, it isn't sufficient to talk about the representations because, as you've, some sense, the same information is being used in every model, the same with the document collection, which we're taking apart to index and then calculate on. So it has to be talking not just about the stuff, but about how we operate on the stuff. That's kind of critically important. And if you think about this, that's the lesson we tried to learn all semester with the faceted classification assigned with your tools, with the vocabulary for describing music or sports. The descriptors you ended up with make a huge difference in the expressive power of your vocabulary and your ability to use it to find stuff. That's what's going on here. We're going to try to find better descriptors than just the words in the documents. But of course, there's a trade-off. The more work you do, likely the more benefit you're going to get. So if you do the lazy man's approach of Boolean indexing, you're going to get bad results. If you do something more sophisticated, you get better results. So, this is a picture. Note to Bob. We draw this with darker lines. Those are yellow vectors in there. You really can't see them very well. Redraw darker. They look really good when you're on your screen. When you put them on the big screen, they kind of look terrible. So I'm sorry about my picture. So the idea here is that we're trying to represent in term space. Here we see T1, T2, T3 as sort of the basis vectors of this space. And then we have represent documents in terms of their values on those terms. And so you see five different documents that have different numbers of each of those terms, and that's why they point to different places in term space. So that's a really nice model because it can be done automatically to find the terms. We can weight them, as we saw last time, based on frequency and on inverse document frequency, basically on the resolving power in the collection. So we can find partial matching on the basis of the terms that are there and not be, have to be all or none, which gives us a very continuous measure of similarity as opposed to the all or none notion of Boolean similarity. And we can change the weights on vectors based on relevance feedback. So those are all the good things about the vector model. But there are some limitations. Fundamentally, the limitation that we're treating the documents as bags of words, we're treating because we're looking at just the total collection of the words in the documents at the surface. We're not looking at what the words mean. We're looking at them as strings that happen to have occurrences in documents. So we don't detect different meanings of the same word, polysemy, and we don't detect the same meaning when it's expressed with different words, namely synonymy. So the question I ask you is, if I have bank as in money and bank as in river in a document, obviously I'm going to be fooled by techniques which rely on the occurrence of words as character patterns and think of those documents are alike when in fact they're not alike. So I'm going to overestimate the similarity. The true similarity is less than what we're going to calculate using the cosine, you know, the vectors. in term space. Likewise, we're going to underestimate the true similarity of words that have synonyms, of documents that have synonyms, because we're going to treat auto and car as different things, even though in fact they're synonyms. So the question I ask would be a great exam question. I'm not going to answer, I'm just going to raise it rhetorically and make you go home and think about it. I think I answered in my notes in the 10 slides, so I can't make an exam question. Damn it. All right. What's the bigger problem? Sort of undetected synonymy or undetected polysemy? That's the question. You think about that for a bit as we keep moving. So is it worse that you don't find, that you don't distinguish bank and bank as different meanings, or that you don't realize that auto and car are the same? That's the key question here. Which one of those is a bigger problem for us to solve? Let's have a flashback to about 2 months ago. We talked about, in the lecture on ontology, we talked about what it meant, what you need to know to understand something. We started with this matrix, or whatever this is, to generate combinations. It was, how many of these made sense? And the question was really, where did meaning come from? And we argued there that the meaning didn't come from just the words. It came from a much broader set of things, the context of use and the knowledge we have behind us. And the question was, how much of that context did we really need to use to understand what was going on in a sense? And a lot of AI has been dedicated to building these knowledge bases like psych or other kinds of ontologies in things like medicine and so on to support the natural language processing task to sort of understand what that stuff was, what words meant. And the question is, do we need that in IR? Can we apply that stuff in IR to solve the polysemy and synonymy challenge that we just showed you? Can we use this kind of language machinery, you know, big ontology, lots of knowledge of the world, can we use that machinery in IR to improve our retrieval performance? Well, there's a big debate about that, right? So everyone agrees that language is important, but they think it's important in a different way. So there's two radically different approaches to NLP. Again, I'm going to caricature this, but basically you have the linguistic approach and the statistical approach. The linguistic approach says, yeah, all that stuff about what meaning is and ontology and phonology and morphology and grammar, all that's really important. You have to use that to basically build effective models of natural language processing. We also have to understand the model of the language processor, like our own memory limitations and processing capacities and so on. And we build that machinery to be able to understand natural language. The alternative view, the statistical view, that says, we don't need any of that stuff. All you need to do is to count things. We just count the occurrences of things, and that will reveal lots of structure, lots of patterns. We can use that to understand, quote-unquote, language. And this sort of extracted knowledge, which is really just co-occurrence probability. What things go with what, okay, in a large enough collection. And that will answer many of the questions that supposedly require understanding or more abstract knowledge. So that's the debate. In fact, this debate has gone back and forth over the last 50 years in quite an interesting way. We started off with a statistical view. We went to a linguistic view, and now we're moving back more toward the statistical view as the dominant view in NLP. How many know what this is? Anyone ever seen it? They have one down at the Computer Museum in Palo Alto. Nobody knows what this is? It's kind of a typewriter, a special kind of typewriter. It's an Enigma machine. It's a code machine. Okay, and it was a typewriter because you typed something in and something else came out. Okay, but what's interesting about this machine was that it had very clever things in it called rotors. And a rotor basically is got 26 things on it, and you kind of turn the dial and so that one thing that you enter gets turned into something else on the other side when the rotor turns around to some other position. Now, if you only had one rotor in a machine, you'd be having a single one-character substitution code. And you all did this when you were kids, right? And you had, let's have a secret code, and you would say, A will be E, and E will be T, and I will be N. And then you had to break this code, and it was really easy because of... Why is it always easy to break a one-letter code? Because of Zipf's law, right? Every language has a characteristic pattern of frequency of its letters, okay? So, and that pattern has a certain shape, right? It's going to be looking like this, right? And in English, what are the most frequent letters in English? Some of you in NLP know this because there's actually it was the title of a program that did this with this name. Edwin Shurdlew was a program written by Terry Winograd to do some natural language processing stuff in like 1975. And that is the most frequent, the decreasing frequency of letters in the English language. Edwin Shurdlew. Any language follows Zipf's law. They just follow different patterns of letters. So if I'm doing Hawaiian, and if you know Hawaiian, think of the words in Hawaiian. Lots of L and M and O and U's, right? Panano pupu kind of words, right? Right? Think of Russian. There'll be a lot of V's in Russian. Think Finnish. There'll be a lot of, you know, K's and N's and P's, cartoon, right? Kota Nurmi, okay? So again, different languages will follow different paths, but they'll all follow Zipf's law. So one letter code is easy to break. Well, what this Enigma did, it had a series of codes where you'd first do a two-letter assigned to a two-letter code. So now you do, so instead of being I goes to A, you say EA goes to TZ. Then you do it again. So you basically have 22 to 2 and then 2 to 2 again. So you have this kind of 26 times 25 kind of, you know, 24. It's a much more complicated code, and it was critical to break this code to win the Second World War. You see in the movies about this, you know, U-boats 571 and all that kind of... You've seen these movies, right? Okay. So, this is really important. This is one of the key things, challenges that actually motivated the science of statistical natural language work. So if you look back to this period, you know, you've seen that just as in the last 10 to 15 years, you've seen cognitive science, you know, get created. We had psychology was created to study language, which was very much about behaviorism and structuralism, sort of stimulus response kind of stuff, and that was the kind of earliest kind of model of language that said you learn language through repetition, you learn these kinds of stimulus response, there's no deep knowledge inside of your head, okay? It's all about just learning these sort of statistical patterns, okay? And that's where Zipf's law comes from in this tradition in the mid-30s. All the work in the World War II by people like Turing. Turing worked and the Enigma Project. Right? He's one of the key mathematicians to break the Enigma box. Claude Shannon comes from this tradition in the late 40s with information theory. A purely statistical notion of information saying that the information in message is not based on its content but by its probability of that pattern of bits being... So that information is when you have an unexpected pattern of bits. That's how you measure how much information the message contains. All statistical kind of stuff. And this lasts about 30 years, from like 1930 to about 1960, late 50s. But it's overturned by one guy. Who's the guy that overturns sort of statistical language theory? Okay, the linguistics major in this class, Sean, where's Michelle? Is she here today? Linguistics major's got to know the answer to this question. Sean, Dan. Big name. Starts with a C. Chomsky. All right. Chomsky comes along in the late 50s and says, no. This is not statistical. There's deep structure in language, and we have to learn it that way. Okay? That's a book called Syntactic Structures in the late 50s. Two famous sentences, which, except for the fact that Chomsky used them, and now they're in everybody's textbooks and all these papers, would never occur naturally in language. Okay? Colorless green ideas sleep furiously. Furiously sleep ideas green colorless. Well, neither of them is a sentence, but the first one sounds a lot more sentential because it has grammatical structure. It follows the rules of sentences in English. It sounds like it could be a sentence. Okay? And that to Chomsky meant something that we had, that language could not be learned on statistical sort of learning theory. We weren't just learning patterns of stimulus response. You never saw those stimuli or anything like them. You can never learn language by just learning stimulus response connections. And there's a wonderful phrase that Chomsky used that I think is just wonderful. It's kind of one of the key phrases of linguistics. It's called the poverty of the stimulus. Surely some of you heard this phrase, the poverty of the stimulus. The idea is that there's not enough stuff out there in what you listen to and read and hear to be able to learn language. You can't just be learning on the basis of what you hear and experience, because you don't experience good stuff. You experience ungrammatical sentences. You experience sort of broken language. I mean, how could a child ever learn to speak, learn a language, if they had to listen to, you know, they had to learn it by basically pattern recognition, pattern learning, stimulus response. You couldn't learn it that way. Okay, so this led to the notion that language was this kind of mathematically formally described system of abstract knowledge. You're learning the language as a grammar, okay? Syntactic structure. That's what you're learning. You're learning rules and transformations of those rules, okay? And that's how you learn language. And that basically dominated language theory for 20 years. People tried to build natural language processing by writing the rules of the language. And then trying to run the rules when you got input to see if you could then, you know, find the meaning by running the rules on the data. But the data fought its way back. And here's why. Okay? Think of these two sentences. Your lie cured mother. You like your mother. They're very, very similar acoustically. In fact, if you're not looking at the slides right now, you probably had no idea that I said two different sentences. Okay. But which of those sentences is more likely if I say that phrase, you're like your mother? Which one is more likely, the first one or the second one? The second one, okay? Well, which means that we have some kind of expectation that we're using to understand language. We have some notion of what's likely to come, given A, what's going to follow A, what comes next. Okay? And what happened was we said, gee, if we basically process huge amounts of data, like speech data in this case, we can build systems that use probability to identify the sound pattern. So we say, what's likely to follow a particular sound? So we know the transition probabilities of the elements in the language at different levels, you know, at different levels of the sound level, at the word level, at the sentence level. And that's how we can say that's why we have these things like garden path sentences, right? When I say the old man, the boat. Perfectly good sentence. But you hear old man, you think, oh, that's the noun phrase, what's coming next? But in fact, the old man is a verb in that sentence. Okay? Those are called garden path sentences. They're fun. Rapper riding with his uninjured hand saved the contents of the capsized canoe. All right? There's a lot of these things, and they sort of you go down the garden path because you have some expectation based on the likely next thing, and then you have to back up and say that wasn't the right interpretation. Okay. So, they've got this idea that we needed natural language processing but use statistics. Now that doesn't mean that people do that. There's a distinction we have to understand between competence and performance. This is another key distinction in linguistics. The idea is that you have some rules that describe how the language works, and that's the knowledge that people have to possess to do it. But it doesn't mean we use that knowledge in that form. Okay, so it doesn't mean we're using the rules of language to make decisions or judgments. If I say, my doctoral thesis was about this, looking at things like if I say tape and tase, you've never seen either of those words before, but you can pronounce them. And when you learn as an elementary school kid, you were taught about phonics and how rules and things like E makes the vowel long, things like that. We don't use any knowledge like that. This is being done by pattern matching to words like have and gave. So you can see interference effects based on those other words in the neighborhood that you couldn't get if you had rules. It's about patterns at a lower level of abstraction. So again, the idea is that we can describe the knowledge as a competence model, but it doesn't mean we use the knowledge in that form to do it. So I want to make the distinction between learning the statistics and statistically driven learning. So what people seem to be doing when they learn language is essentially building up knowledge about the probability of these transition events, what's likely to follow the next thing. And they do that, and they're building knowledge which is more general than the patterns they got, which is how you overcome the poverty of the stimulus. Okay, so the idea is that you learn to learn. You basically build up from very simple, sort of maybe genetic baseline learning mechanisms, and you build more sophisticated rules over time. It's a wonderful book that just came out by Alison Gopnik. Anyone know who Alison Gopnik is? Professor in psychology on the Berkeley campus. She wrote a book called The Philosopher Baby. It's going to be a bestseller. Okay? And her Philosopher Baby book says that we need to look at what children do as they learn in a very different way. They're not sitting there as passive blank slabs being poured into. They're basically hypothesis testing learning machines. So they said, when you have it, Jackson, you should buy this book for Christmas. Buy this book and read it over Christmas, seriously. Give us a report back in January. So this book basically says that if we look at the baby look, it's not like just wandering around looking. It's basically doing experiments, trying to test hypotheses, and it's learning probabilities about the world. Really cool book. So again, it doesn't mean we have Bayesian rules engines in our heads, but it does mean we have some notion of statistics and probabilities that we can build in, say, like neural nets as a way to capture this notion that we know things about the language probabilities in order to understand stuff. So we've now come around where we're now saying, gee, we no longer say that language, we need to attack language as either a linguistic problem or a data problem. It's kind of a hybrid problem. And most big systems have some combination of these two approaches built into them. You'll have things like dictionaries and grammars to do parsing and some disambiguation, do morphological analysis to strip affixes and suffixes off. We talked about that the other day as part of text processing for indexing. But this idea that we use statistical co-occurrence or conditional probability as a major portion of how we understand language is important. And the important point is that doesn't make any use of the languages of the input. It's all about patterns of occurrence of things that are not being treated as linguistic at all. They're being treated as just patterns of things. And the really interesting idea there is that the web, of course, is such a big corpus that statistics of the web are statistics of the language. So we have a really robust way to build language models from just the collection of text on the web. And they match, in terms of their description of how the language works, better than any linguist could write sitting in his armchair writing rules about how the language works. So, with that kind of aside, I want to talk about dimensionality reduction. That's sort of the essential idea that we're saying. It's going to be almost a paradox that we're going to take a purely statistical approach and improve the precision of our retrieval. It's as if we have better knowledge of the language, but it's all done statistically. And that's really kind of a surprising thing to a lot of people, that you throw information away and you get a better result. So throwing away the right information. So, the big idea is that we take a vector model that which starts with the document by term matrix. The dimensionality of that space is the number of different terms in it. So for a large collection, it could be 100,000 or 200,000 terms might appear in the collection. 200,000 stemmed terms. That's an enormous collection of terms. It's an enormous matrix, most of which is zero. Okay? But the semantic dimensionality, if you want to treat that word in quotes, meaning what is the collection about, they're not 100,000 different topics. We can think of it, you know, in terms of concepts, like car and auto. That's one concept. That's one equivalence class. All right? We talked about categories. How many categories of meanings are there versus how many stems are there? Very different question. It's much lower. Okay? And that's because untapped synonymy is more important than unnoticed polysemy. I shouldn't have put that in the slide. It would have been a great exam question. Right? Make sure you understand that. It's a statistical question. Are there more situations where you have bank and bank having two meanings, or where you have car and auto? Obviously, there's way more synonymy than there is polysemy. Because if we had more polysemy than synonymy, we wouldn't be able to function very well. The world would be too ambiguous. It would be too hard to understand language. So in some sense, words like bank and bank are problematic. We have to work around that by having context, right? So that it's harder to do. You're better off not having any of that. So languages try to avoid that if they can, just because it makes the language harder to learn. Yes.
So with this approach,
bank will have to show up in two vectors. Exactly right. Because bank has two meanings, there's gotta be two vectors for it. So we have to invent. There have to be another vector added for that one, but we hope it can get rid of more of the vectors for when we collapse and treat a car and auto as the same thing. So we're going to try to find this. Here's what we're going to try to find. Thank you for anticipating my next slide. So if this is, actually, it would help if I wrote this and I put bank and bank on it. So this bank river is here, bank financial institution is here. Okay, they're going to be two different topics. However, car, auto, vehicle can become one vector now. They're going to kind of crunch down to one topic. So if intuitively, we're going to reduce the dimensionality because we're going to find more synonyms than we're going to have to create new vectors because of polysemy. Are we still hanging in here? So again, polysemy is less important problem than untapped synonymy. Okay. And here's why it's going to work. Okay? Words don't appear randomly in documents. They occur because they are what the document's about. And so we look at what things co-occur, that gives us a way to figure out what documents are about. Co-occurrences with frequent words are not very interesting, which is why we throw them out in the first place, or why we just weight them so low they don't really influence our results. Because doctor co-occurs with a lot of things, with, the, and so on. But it also co-occurs with honorary, nurse, examine, treat, and so on. And drug, think about this, drug occurs with price prescription in patients when we're talking about medical context, and it occurs with paraphernalia, illicit shooting up, right? Crime in the illicit context, in the non-medical context. So we can look at these patterns of co-occurrence and identify topics. So let's find that drug clump and let's find the medical clump. And all the words that are co-occurring there, we can kind of smush together as if they were just one clump. One topic vector versus many term vectors. Okay? Let me give you another motivation for this. So, think about this. All the data in your collection, remember, is represented as a term by document matrix, but the matrix is very sparse. Because, think about how this matrix is created. I go find a bunch of documents about doctors, and I start the matrix with, you know, the documents and the words. So the words are going to be doctor, patient, drug, insurance, nurse, treatment, so on, right? Then I go find some documents, and these are going to be documents about school. So I find professor, student, grade, exam, and so on. This is this clump. They don't have doctor, patient. They have nothing here, right? Okay? And so on. So I'm finding these clumps of words. The matrix is going to have these little like ghettos packed with words about the topic that document's about. And these ghost towns where nothing, no one lives. So we have all these ghost towns with the zeros where there's nothing about doctors in the school documents, and so on. So we had to sort of think of that. There's a lot of stuff going on here where we, as we add new documents, what those documents are about, we add those new terms, but everything else is going to have a lot of zeros in it. So, imagine if we could get rid of all those ghettos, all the ghost towns, and throw them away so there's no more zeros left in this matrix. And where all there's a lot of clusters, kind of identify those as those topics and just replace all that little that little ghetto with one point. Okay? So, that's what we want to do, and that's what the singular value decomposition magic does. Very cool, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to say, that's what we're going to say. That any matrix, any M by N matrix, can be rewritten as a set of other matrices, particular forms. This is going to be an orthogonal matrix with eigenvectors, and this is going to be a singular matrix with only non-zero elements along the diagonal, so on. Magic. Okay? What we're saying is, this is the document matrix we start with, document by terms. We're going to rewrite it as some other matrices that have special properties. Okay? So, less formally, the original matrix will be decomposed into three matrices that when you multiply them, you get the exact data back. Okay? That doesn't help us. We don't want the beta DAC. We want to make the data simpler. So, the matrix in the middle, in this case, has this magic property that the singular value, which is why it's called SVD, singular value decomposition, is going to have only values along the diagonal, and they're going to be essentially weights, where the big weights will be in the upper left of that diagonal, and the small letter numbers will be, as we move to the right, in the lower part of that. And so we can take this matrix and we can shrink it down. Okay? So we can find a smaller matrix that approximates the original matrix by tossing out things which are going to have low weight. Any vector that has a low weight, we can kind of toss out. We know what that is because those are the ones on the lower part of that diagonal. So we replace our 100,000 term matrix with like a 300 term matrix, 300 topic matrix. And they're no longer really identifiable because we've now, they're statistically identified. Then you can't say, well, that's the nurse, that's the medical clump, and that's the school clump. But you can find the sort of, such as latently semantic because they account for the variance in the original document by term matrix. So we've extracted this kind of factors. We can't really identify them explicitly, but we know that together they account for all the variance, or most of the variance in the original matrix. Another try at this picture now. So, okay, so we have this original term by document matrix here, plus the three-factored matrices here, if we can say, you know, most of this stuff is really, they're factors that are not very important. They're the ones which have the count for a very small amount of the variance in this matrix. So we can toss, by tossing up the lower part of this matrix here, effectively this matrix shrinks to a very small one, as does this one. So we end up with a lot smaller rows and columns in our model. We now have the same number of documents can be now accounted for with a much smaller number of topics rather than terms. And this is basically one variety, and that's why there's differences in the papers about, there's many different varieties of this approach. Some of them are called principal components analysis or factor analysis or things like that. You've done this before. You take in psychology quizzes or some kind of personality test. You fill out 100 questions. So now we have a matrix of people by questions that has a gazillion people times 100 questions. I'm going to say, no, there are only four kinds of people. They're INTJs, right? Introverts, extroverts, whatever they are, right? So we've sort of said, let's factor that matrix of people by questions and make it people by four dimensions that account for most of the variance of that original question matrix. You've done, this is basically, which I'm reducing the dimensionality of the personality test to four dimensions. Same principle here. Okay? Does that make sense? If you can understand the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiple Personality Index, whatever it is, you can understand LSI. We're just reducing the dimensionality by doing matrix magic, by doing this, finding particular kinds of matrices that let us say, while these are important ones here, this is the INTJ, the most important dimension. The rest of them are, who knows, we just toss them out. So we toss out most of the terms because they don't, in the new factoring of the data, they don't count for very much of the variation. So we're trying to minimize the unexplained variation. And we can find the statistically optimal set of dimensions that have the best fit at the smallest number of dimensions. So we turn a 100,000 term matrix into a 300 term matrix. I'm going to show you an example. Wow, this is going fast. I guess that makes sense. We're not talking very much about stuff. I'm just showing you stuff. Okay. It's kind of hard to have a discussion about singular value decomposition. Yeah. Tell me the name of my exam question. Did anyone hear this question? Great question. Great question. Could you apply this concept to things like tag bundles? You know, again, how do you describe what you know? Of course, anytime you have an n-dimensional space where there's co-occurrences, you can reduce the dimensionality with techniques like this. So you say, you tend to write about the Navy. Because you all these different words you use, but they're all basically naval terms. Okay? Make sense? All right. So in the original paper, or one of the original papers by these guys, Dumais and Furness and the people you know from the vocabulary problem, they have an example. I'm going to go through this example a little bit here because it helps with a more concrete illustration. So they took a bunch of technical memos from their lab at Bell Labs, and they had two kinds of memo categories that they knew they started with. They had memos which were basically about human-computer interaction, and they had memos which were about graph theory or matrix theory of some kind. Okay, so here you see five documents whose titles are things like human-machine interface and so on, and they're labeled C1 through C5, and then there's M1 to M4. So there's nine documents in this collection. They can create from those nine documents this sort of kind of document by term matrix. These are the words that occur in the titles. And they're going to use this collection. It's very simple. You can just use the titles of the documents as the data they want to fit. Okay? So, That's the original term by document matrix. They apply the singular value decomposition magic, and they produce three matrices, which you can't read. That's not the point here. But you see, this is, it's enough data here with the right number of rows and columns that when you do the multiplication, you end up with that original matrix. And these are going to be the weights, the kind of the co-occurrence cosines, as it were, between the different documents in the collection. Now, you notice that if you look at this row, you see that at the top of the singular value matrix, 3.34, 2.54, 2.35, 1.64, they decrease down that diagonal. By the time you get here, you have 0.36, which is one-tenth the size of the one in the upper left-hand corner. So intuitively, you say, well, that means it's one-tenth as important as the one in the upper left-hand corner. Okay? So whatever we've done in this matrix, we've taken what was a 12-dimensional matrix, because there's 12 terms. And now we've said, those 12, this one is one-tenth as big as that one. So we've factored it out somehow, and we've got more of the variations now pushed up in the upper left-hand corner of this matrix. So I'm going to throw away all but the top two. All right? So I throw away all but the top two here. So now at the top I have an approximation to the original data. And when I do the multiplication, I get this now instead of the original matrix. And it's different. It's different in ways that make sense. What we've done is we've said, if you look at, for example, the next slide here. Okay. In the original term by document matrix, the first document, which was called Human Machine Interface for Lab ABC Computer Applications, didn't have these documents, didn't have some of those words. Okay? But when we look at the reconstruction matrix with the lower dimensionality, we now have positive numbers, which suggests that those documents are about something, even though they don't have the words in them. So we're now sort of, we've created kind of more similarity there because we have a dimension which now is capturing the fact that those words tend to occur together, human, computer, and so on. Even though the words don't occur, we're getting credit for them having co-occurred in the collection. That's what we're doing. So basically we're changing the set of dimensions in order to have squeezed more of the variation into a small number of the kind of key dimensions, the key factors. And sure enough, when we draw this picture graphically, boy, this was hard to draw too. Okay. Hope you appreciate this picture. Because I redrew it in color from a lame one. Okay. So let's look at my key code in the upper right-hand corner. The HCI documents are dash underlined, and the HCI terms are full underlined. So here you see document 1 is right here. It has three of the terms in it, 1, 2, and 3, and it appears right here. Likewise, this is document 3, document 2, and so on. That's where they occur in this new space. Okay? And likewise, the graph theory ones are the blue ones. Notice that they occur. They've now been clustered. We've now extracted the dimensions of, like, graph theoriness and human-computer theoriness as the two dimensions. We sort of pull them out now from that 11-dimensional space. We now have two dimensions, which look like we're pulling out HCI stuff and graph theory stuff. So now when I do a query for human computer, term 1 and term 3, okay, this is the 90-degree cosine, okay? We get all those documents are now being caught in that human computer query, even though some don't have the words human computer in them. Because, you see that? This 1 and 3, this document has 1, 2, 3. It should be fine because it's close. 1, 2, 3 has 1 and 3 in it, right?
This one has 4, 6, and 7. But it's found. It's close enough to be found because those words tend to occur with the ones that it does that are in the collection, that are in the query. And likewise, we don't get any of these because they're too far away. So we've reduced the dimensionality from 11 to 2, and we're doing a better job of distinguishing documents.
That's pretty cool.
Okay. So think about this. You toss out some of the words. You think, well, I should do worse. I should have less precision. I have fewer words to work with. But we're not tossing out words randomly. We're replacing them with these kinds of hyper words, these clusters of co-occurring words, equivalence classes that are more latently semantic. Yes, Dan? Oh, great question. What he's saying is, well, this sounds great if you have a collection all at once, but can you do it kind of incrementally? And the answer is, it doesn't work so good that way. And that's one of the problems of this method, that it's computationally very difficult, and it doesn't work incrementally. Now, the two views of LSA. I think that they've shown without a doubt that it's a practical technique for essentially estimating the semantic equivalence of words in larger text segments. So we're creating these equivalence classes in which human-computer interaction and, you know, even though we can find those documents because human-computer interaction words tend to occur together, even though they may not be exactly those words in any particular document. In addition, there are people who say, gee, like Susan DeMeo in the paper, that this must have some relation to what people are actually doing when they do natural language processing, because I can get data in from people that looks like data from LSA. Okay? That's not to say, again, that's a competence model. We don't have, you know, singular value decomposition machines in our head. But we are doing something that statistically like extracting semantic dimension, which sort of makes sense. It's like, how do I understand things? I have some notion of what things mean, and I can distinguish, you know, the difference between military words and peace words and government words and education words. I can invent new words, do a lot of that. I have to have some abstract machinery based on concept, not just on words. So this has led some of the LSA people to do a lot of I think creative work to apply this technique in places where you might not think you should be able to get away with it, because it looks very much like things that people do, but LSA is doing just about as good as people do, like grading exams, for example. Yes, Dan.
Well, it's we see this in our natural senses with physical objects, that anything that remains that's too common, we discard. It's not, you know, it's not physically a threat to us or a source of food. So something that remains in place becomes noise, and we discard it, say visually. Or
right. Right. We are throwing away, this is really throwing away the noise. You're exactly right. We're saying, you know, the fact that documents, you know, for some reason use the word sailor rather than naval person, okay, that was just an accidental choice of word. It doesn't change what the topic was about. And so that's kind of noise in the system, which this system will toss out and says, well, we're talking about naval people, so we can, you know, treat sailors and naval officers as the same kind of object. Okay, so let me show you some examples, because there are some really cool ones here. If you go to lsacolorado.edu, which is sort of one of the homes for this sort of stuff, because lsacolorado.edu, Tom Landauer, who was the head of the research group at Bell Labs and Belco for a long time, that George Furness and Sue DeMay were in, retired as a professor of psychology to the University of Colorado at Boulder. And that's, they started building up a kind of LSA research group there. And there's a bunch of terrible user interface, but some cool tools to play with
And I'm going to show you some of them here just for fun. The first one is the near neighbors. And near neighbors works like, again, it's not a very nice interface, but the idea is that they have a number of different collections. This one is general reading for first year college students. It's a 300 dimensional space. And if I go to a very famous book that I know very well, chapter one of my book, and I take this and I feed it to LSA, this thing, and I say, here's a paragraph of my book, find things in the collection, words that this thing reminds you of, sort of. And sure enough, it will find words. Businesses, telegraph, profit, telephone, communication, enterprises, developments, business persons, entrepreneurs, 20th, money, advances, century, entrepreneur. Alright? Those are words it finds in the collection, some of which are in my collection, but not all of them are. So my stuff is about innovation in information intensive industries, and this finds that kind of word space. I can take another book, like the first chapter of Dean Saxenian's book on regional advantage, and take this, and I can shove this into LSA, and I can find that it finds different words, and including words like toiletries and crock pots, because she's writing about regional economies. And so there must be some papers about regional economy talk about distinctive products of different economies and so on, and you find things like that. Okay? But it also talks about manufacturing and economics and so on. Yes, Amy.
When you plugged your book in there, one of the terms was a number, it said 359.
Yeah, where did that come from?
Yeah.
It came from I got a lot of numbers in there. Like 20, talk about 24/7, the virtual enterprise working. 20th and 21st, so 19th. So I must somehow figure out that there were a lot of numbers in my. So I look for documents that were number intensive about those subjects. Don't know. Statistical, not linguistic. Okay. So that kind of thing, you can imagine how that would be as related to, what is this document about? Okay, you throw it into the collection, and it comes back with possible indexing terms that you might not have thought of, perhaps. Here's the one about grading exams. There's been a lot of work to use, and I hate to say this because many of you just recently did this, like say GREs or college entrance exams. They are using this to grade essay questions. They have a model answer. They say, well, how close is this essay to the model answer? Think about it. It doesn't read the essay. It doesn't look at the syntactic structure of the answer. It just looks at what is it about in a purely statistical way. But let me show you how that works. So, I took the sample answer from the Memex versus Delicious question, okay, and I went to this little Colorado place, and there's one called One to Many Comparison. Where is One to Many Comparison? One-to-many comparison. You basically say, here is the test, the main text I'm going to compare with, my model answer, and then I do a bunch of other body of text and see how close they are, and rank them in closest to that model answer. So, I took the model answer from MX and Delicious, use it as the target, and then ran five things against it. My first paragraph from my book, the first paragraph from Dean Saxenian's book, and then two other answers. Okay? So look which the closest one, the two and three, which are the other two exam questions, got 0.96 and 0.93. That's good. They answered the same question. They should get pretty good rate to the model answer. My book got 0.89 because it was about technology and information, which is sort of the Memex kind of space, right? Dean Saxenian's book, which is about economic regional development, was the lowest graded one because it wasn't very much on point. Okay? So I can detect the relative aboutness of those five essays
by feeding them against LSA? But that's just one paragraph of answers. You could obviously do a better job with a longer essay. Yes. What? I mean, did they get good grades?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how I did. How did LSA? You guys used LSA for this, didn't you, when you graded the exam?
Yeah.
So see, it must have worked out fine. It's a lazy man's way to grade papers. Just feed it to LSA and it spits out grades. This is really close to the model answer. You think I'm kidding? This shows it, right? That purely statistical language processing has given us something which, if you gave it to a graduate student and said, read these, rank these in order, and how close they are to the model exam, they would have got this result.
You say that the GREs and whatever, that they're doing this right now. And have there? I'm assuming there have been, but
sort of
what kind of studies have been done versus a human grader?
Well, let's just for fun. I'm just gonna roll the dice and say LSA grading exams. Sorry, right? LSA Handbook for Faculty and Staff. How to do this? Right.
I think there's like a letter
to
science and art.
Oh, good. Oh. No, this is it. This is how to grade exams using this. Okay? All right? But there's some papers on it. Wired Magazine, The Washington Post, New Software Checks Essay Content, Software Essay Eases Grading, How a Computer Program. I mean, I'm not kidding you. Okay? And they vote.
Yeah. It's kind of a combined score.
Well, that makes sense. You get twice the productivity of a human grader.
So my mom actually graded tests for ETS, for not for the GRE, but for the SAT.
And then she got laid off and replaced by a machine.
No. So the thing that's interesting about it is that she said they were taught not to necessarily grade on the content of it. That they would basically look at the structure and see, like, did this person write a topic sentence? Are there details that support it? But it could kind of be about anything, as long as it was somewhat relevant to the question. It wasn't actually grading how well you answered the question. It was, like, how well you wrote a structural essay. So it's interesting.
This is exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
So that's why I made two of them together. It would be a great, great test, right? The human reader grades on, did you write a coherent essay? Is there some kind of argumentation structure? And the machine says, are you on point? And the grade is probably the average of the two. Twice as productive as people would be. Wow. Okay, well, fortunately this is hard to do in practice. It's very computationally intensive because you've got to crunch on this giant matrix into a smaller one. And it is yet to be used for more than a million documents. And that sounds like a lot, but if the web has trillions of documents in it, or billions of documents, then we're not going to LSA the web right away. Okay? And it also doesn't have a good way to do negation, you know, in queries. All right. Okay. With that, I think we're done for the day. I have just pointed out where we're going for the rest of the week. We have two more lectures on IR models. They're both called structure-based models. The first one will be about using the link structure, that is the structure between documents to build a retrieval model. And then the lecture on Monday will be about structure within documents, mostly about XML document retrieval. There are three papers. They're going to be trimmed down significantly to make your reading less. Although the first paper is fascinating, this is a paper written as an undergraduate on a thesis by a kid at Stanford a few years ago named Alejandro Diaz. I assigned it because it's the best explanation of how Google worked in terms of the algorithms and sort of the big philosophy of it that I've ever read. Undergraduate thesis at Stanford. And the basic premise of this is how Google's algorithms basically are biased toward keeping the rich richer, in the sense that if you have a thing which is based on what things are linked to, then of course you'll find things which are linked to because they're the ones you found, and then they get linked to more, and you kind of enforce the existing status quo. That's his argument. But the explanations of how Google works are quite good. The Manning book, of course, will have a very computationally intelligent description of all this. And then I have an easy paper to read about using linking, namely scientific citation, to understand things about properties of scientific journals. Classic work on bibliometrics that is being, you know, constantly updated. So I'm going to go back, and as I'm not really showing you what I think the most important slides are. So go back to the beginning, and I'll stop for a minute or two on the most important ones. This we've hit on now three different, you've seen this slide three times, you'll see it two more times probably, because every lecture I want to emphasize what we're doing about the IRM model. What problems we're trying to solve and how we solve them. The vector model has some strengths and has some weaknesses. And the key one we want to overcome here is the problem of untapped synonymy. We're going to do that by reducing the dimensionality of the space. We contrasted a little bit today about the linguistic and the statistical approach to language processing. And again, they're caricatures because they're now being used kind of together in practice, but fundamentally they're very different ideologies about how to make sense of the world. And I want to point out, this is not how we do it, even if we do statistical processing, but we are clearly doing something that has some of the same outcome. Then we're able to predict the likelihood of language events. So we have to combine these approaches, and you'll see in another couple of weeks when we talk about the web as corpus, you'll see that it's such a huge collection of data that the statistics of the web can be used for all sorts of interesting things in natural language processing. All right, the idea of dimensional reduction, I hope is pretty clear by now. We're going to reduce using co-occurrences of words, identify topics or themes rather than the actual words. These represent kind of clusters of co-occurring terms, which lets us reduce a big matrix into a much smaller one that still accounts for most of the useful variation in the original data. And I hope that example of the personality test is one that kind of sticks in your head, because it really says, think about this idea that there's four kinds of people, you INTJ or whatever that stuff is. That's four dimensions out of all the questions that you could ask someone about the behavior and personality. So we reduce this very large space of factors to these four in order to have better predictive value. And the simple example here I showed you, that a two-dimensional model versus an 11-dimensional model was able to find the right stuff. In fact, it found it better because it found things which did not even have the words in the collection. Okay.